meditation. And since we've been discussing karma, let's rejoice that we have karma ripening right now that enables us to be in contact with the Dharma, and that indicates that certainly in previous lives we created a lot of air to be able to have this opportunity. And I suspect that we can't really appreciate what our opportunity is, that somehow we don't really understand or really get what samsara is all about and how horrific it is. And so we don't really appreciate how rare and difficult it is to meet the Dharma and to have the opportunity to learn it and practice it after having met it. But I suspect if we were to really understand these things deep in our heart, it would really blow us away. So let's try and think outside of our narrow little box about our little world and what we like and what we don't like and what we have to do and what time we have to get it done by. And think for a minute of what it feels like to be wandering in the six realms under the force of ignorance and afflictions and polluted karma. Getting born, old, sick, dying, and then repeating that again and again. Going from high status to low status, from rich to poor, to having what we like, to having hardly anything. How totally unpredictable cyclic existence is. And so understanding that, have some intention to get ourselves out by accumulating merit and wisdom, and to help others to get out of their cyclic existence as well by practicing wisdom conjoined with bodhicitta. So with that kind of motivation, let's listen to the teachings tonight about karma. So real freedom comes from eliminating the ignorance that's the root of cyclic existence. But in that the absence of that, understanding karma can give us a lot of power. Because when we understand karma, then we can create the causes for the situation we want and avoid the kind of causes for the situation we don't want. And so that's very beneficial to do until we can actually generate the wisdom that overcomes ignorance and gets us out of cyclic existence. So the topic of karma is really quite important. So we're going to continue talking about karma. Hopefully finish that section tonight. I would really like to, but we'll see. So I think we talked about the eight special conditions and their causes, and then the three kinds of factors that enhance or enrich those causes. Okay, we've talked about what makes karma heavy and light. Okay, we've talked about classes of karma and certain and uncertain karma. Okay, here we go. Okay, so we're at the section now in the Gomchen Langyam about how to practice cause and effect in general. Okay, so I'll teach from some notes and then we'll go back to the text. Okay, so the we should really contemplate all these teachings that we've heard about karma in the light of our own actions and learn how to evaluate our own actions, whether they're virtuous or non-virtuous, and learn how to see whether they're heavy or light according to the various factors that make them heavy and light, and then to develop the kind of introspective awareness that can really discern what our motivation is, because our motivation is a really key factor in determining the value of our actions. Okay, so there's a lot really to process here. It's not just a thing of learning a bunch of information, but it's a way of using this outline, using this information to understand our own actions better and to understand the occurrences in our own life better. Yeah. And as we do that, then more and more we stop blaming others for our problems and start realizing that when we have problems, it's due to our own actions. And the chief culprit is our afflictions. And the chief things that lie behind the afflictions, of course, are the self-grasping ignorance and the self-centered attitude. And so doing our best to overcome those. Okay? Understanding karma and its effects also helps us develop some conviction in the valid speech or the reliable speech of the Buddha, because he's the only one who understands the intricacies of cause and effect completely, especially when it comes to specific events experienced by specific people, but even some of the general things. I remember when I was in Russia, somebody asked me one question about karma, and I just had to say, you know, we got to refer that one to the Buddha. I don't know. Yeah. Okay. Also, the more we understand emptiness, if we have a correct understanding of emptiness, the more we will appreciate the functioning of karma and its effects. Yeah. So if we find that in we're meditating on emptiness and beginning to think, oh, karma doesn't exist and this whole thing of cause and effect doesn't exist, then our understanding of emptiness is not complete, because it's incorrect actually, because it's gone to the extreme of nihilism. Okay. So that's why they say that it's so important before doing real serious meditation on emptiness to really meditate a lot on karma and its effects, so that we have a very robust understanding and conviction of this. And then that way we won't, when we learn about emptiness, we won't just throw out karma and think, you know, that nothing exists, so we don't need to think about it. And this is really important, because especially you hear people who jump into Vajrayana and don't have a proper understanding, and they say, oh, but when you're a yogi, there's no good and there's no bad, and you're beyond karma. Actually, that's completely incorrect, you know. When you're a yogi with a realization of emptiness, you have incredible respect for karma, because you have an understanding of how intricate and how detailed and how infallible dependent arising is, you know, and that things don't happen accidentally or randomly, but everything comes due to its own causes. Yeah, so you really respect cause and effect very, very much. And I say this because there's a lot of misunderstanding in the West. Sometimes I remember even going to some Buddhist teachers' conferences and like what people were saying and doing. And it's like, no, this is not what my teachers taught me, you know. So I have to understand that quite well. Then, you know, when we get an understanding of cause and effect, what kind of actions are constructive, what are destructive, what the results are, then to really develop mindfulness and introspective awareness that help us to monitor our own behavior. So mindfulness is the mental factor in this case that helps us remember what our precepts are. It helps us remember what the 10 non-virtues are, what the 10 virtues are, so that these remain in our mind. They're not just, you know, well, I know them if I look at the list, but, you know, they're usually out of sight. So, you know, really bearing those in mind, and then with introspective awareness, monitoring, you know, what are we thinking, what are we saying, what are we doing, yeah, what are we feeling, and developing a very refined, very subtle awareness of all these factors so that we can make good decisions and really check if we're using our time wisely and creating virtue or if we're wasting time or not. Yeah. So, you know, somebody who practices this very well, even when they're walking from one place to the other, they're aware of what their thoughts are. They're aware if their thoughts are virtuous or non-virtuous. They are aware of what their body's doing, how they're moving through space. And if they're doing something that's not very skillful, then they correct it right then and there on the spot. Yeah. So, you know, this kind of study of karma helps us really refine our behavior and abandon the negativity and create a lot of virtue. Yeah. So we should... when they talk about the measure of understanding karma, yeah, kind of what constitutes a good understanding of karma, is when before, you know, you cared more about this life than future lives, but now you care more about future lives than this life. So some people would say, well, you care more about future lives, but what about being in the present? Actually, if you care about future lives, you live very vividly in the present. Because if you care about future lives, you're very aware that at this very moment, you are creating the causes for your future lives. So you become very aware of what you're doing and thinking and so on right now. Whereas when we don't care very much about future lives, then we're lost in hopes and fears and daydreams and attachment and grudges, and our mind is floating all over the universe, you know, not able to land on anything substantial. And so we basically waste our time, waste our lives. Yeah? Whereas really caring about future lives helps us be right where we are right now and pay attention to what's going on. Yeah? Because right now is when we're creating the causes, and right now is, you know, when we're alive. Okay? And then also another advice here is to really try and practice according to the Kadam Geshe's. So these are the, you know, when Lama Atisha came, and Drumtompa, his lay disciple, then their descendants, spiritual descendants, were the three types of Kadam Geshe's. And these people were really pure practitioners. There's a lot of stories of them, and you can tell from the stories about them that they were really meticulous in how they observed karma and its effects. And it's said, in fact, that refuge and karma and its effects were the favorite topics that Lama Atisha taught. So his disciples were very careful about this. And, you know, when you're careful about karma, then your day-to-day behavior changes. Yeah? And we become kinder people. We become less obnoxious, less rude, you know, because we're aware of the kind of seeds we're imprinting in our mind moment by moment by our actions of body, speech, and mind. Okay? So, then I thought I'd, since we're talking about karma, I'd talk a little bit about the five heinous actions too, in case you haven't heard about those. So these are our five actions that, according to the Sutrayana, you can't purify in this life. You have to experience, the result in the very next life. It's kind of like, go directly to jail, do not pass go, do not collect $200. You know, I wonder if they increased how much you get in Monopoly with inflation. Yeah, I haven't played that in a long time. Okay, so the five are first killing our father and killing our mother. So these are referring to our genetic parents. So of course, you know, killing whoever it was who brought you up, too, is very serious. But these ones are specifically killing your genetic parents because those are the ones who gave us this life. Yeah, and so they're kind for that reason. But the ones who brought us up very often are even kinder, aren't they? Yeah, sometimes you don't know who your genetic parents are, but the people who brought you up are the ones who really shaped you. So I think it could extend to them as well, you know, in my mind. And the reason that this is so negative is because of their kindness to us. So this brings up the whole question of assisted suicide. Because I remember having a friend in Seattle who I hadn't seen in a while, and then we got together and we took a walk around Green Lake, and she was telling me how her father, you know, was terminally ill and asked her and the other siblings to please assist him in killing himself, and she did, you know, because he had requested. And I was thinking, wow, you know, what kind of karma is that? Now, of course, it's not going to be nearly as bad as, you know, out of anger killing your parents or something, because here the parents are asking for it. But still, it's quite negative, because it's interesting. In our monastic precepts, the story behind the root precept to abandon killing is that some monks were meditating on the foul nature of the body. They got so into it that they really began to hate their body. So they asked another monk, please kill me to free me from this disgusting body. So he figured since the monks had asked him, he should do it. And when the Buddha came back and said, where are all the monks? And he said, he told them what happened. He said, no, you know, you don't kill anybody even though they ask. So, so this is something to really be aware of nowadays when there's so much discussion about assisted suicide. You know, it's a touchy subject. And I think it's much better overall, and I really encourage everybody to please write a, you know, what an advance directive about what you want to happen to you if you're in a comatose state or in a state where you can't make your wishes known. Because if you do that, then it, you know, then whatever other people do, they're just carrying out your wishes. They're not making any decisions with their own intention. The third one is killing the third of the heinous actions is killing an arhat. Okay, again because of their spiritual realizations. Fourth is drawing the Buddha's blood, so in the sense of injuring a Buddha. Okay. And the fifth is causing schism in the Sangha. In other words, if there's a group of Sangha, dividing it into two groups of at least four or more fully ordained people. Okay, so, you know, clearly harming the Buddha's body is negative. That's kind of obvious, you know, because you're impeding his ability to benefit sentient beings. And causing discord and this kind of schism in the Sangha is very serious because the Sangha has so many qualities, and because the existence of the Dharma very much depends on the existence of the Sangha. And in our Pratimoksha text, you know, when the verse is at the end, it says harmony in the Sangha is the quickest cause for nirvana, or the essential cause for nirvana. Which is not what you would expect. You would expect, you know, deep meditation or something is the important cause for nirvana. But no, he says harmony in the Sangha is. Then there's five parallel heinous actions. So these are like five auxiliary ones. Yeah, they're not quite as bad as the major ones, but they're almost as bad. So here are the first one. That's similar to killing your father, would be killing a bodhisattva. So specifically a bodhisattva who has collected merit for two countless great eons. So this would be somebody who's probably almost on the eighth bhumi or on the eighth bhumi. Second one is killing an arya. So someone who is on the path of seeing or higher. So that is similar to killing an arhat. The third one is stealing the provisions or the funds of the Sangha. So that's similar to causing schism in the Sangha. So, you know, by stealing or taking by force the Sangha's possessions, then you're impeding their ability to practice. So that's not so good. Yeah. And then the fourth is destroying a monastery or a stupa with anger. That's similar to drawing the Buddha's blood. So here, you know, you can think of countries like Tibet or China or Cambodia or Vietnam, you know, where there was a lot of upheaval and you had these young people who were soldiers and they went and destroyed monasteries or stole the possessions of the Sangha. You know, so it's not that these actions, nobody ever creates these actions. They're definitely created even during our lifetimes. We can see people who do them. And then fifth is committing incest with one's mother, who is an arhat. Or another way of putting it is having intercourse with a bhikshuni and causing her to lose her precepts. So that's similar to killing your mother. So raping bhikshunis is not a good idea. But it happens. Yeah? Okay, then I have a little bits here and there about karma that I think it's interesting to mention. So we talk about the karma itself, which is predominantly the mental factor of intention, although it could be the spiritual, it could be the physical action or the verbal action as well. And the karma leaves, the most standard explanation is that it leaves imprints, okay, or it leaves seeds. In general, karmic seeds, karmic imprints are the same thing. I mean, that's what I've heard usually. Once in a while you hear somebody making a difference between them, but general, you know, a karmic seed or a karmic imprint. you know, is what carries the potential to produce the result in the future. The imprints, the karmic seeds themselves, are neutral phenomena. They're abstract composites, so they're impermanent, but they belong to that category that's neither form nor consciousness, but abstract composites. So you don't say the virtuous seed of karma. You have to say the seed of virtuous karma, because the seed itself is not virtuous. It's unspecified. It's neutral. Okay? Okay, so the action may be positive or negative, but the seed of the that's left over after the action is neutral. So we don't say the virtuous seed of karma. We say the seed of virtuous karma. Okay? And unspecified or neutral karma is karma which can't give rise to a maturation result. In other words, it's not powerful enough to cause a rebirth. Yeah, because a maturation result, you're either born in the lower realms or the upper realms, so it's got to be a result of either destructive or constructive karma. Neutral karma can't cause a rebirth. Yeah. So neutral karma is when you're doing nothing in particular, so you're sweeping the floor or taking out the garbage, you know. There's no particular virtuous or non-virtuous motivation, which is why it's so easy to transform those actions into virtue by thinking, when we're taking out the garbage, you know, I'm discarding all the afflictions and karma of sentient beings, or I'm tossing away the self-centered mind, or purifying the karma of sentient beings. So just by adding that kind of thought training teaching, then you're able to transform what would be a neutral action into something constructive. Yeah, the seed itself is neutral. Okay, sometimes we run across the phrase cutting the root of virtue. This is a very difficult phrase. I can't say I totally understand it. But what it means is that you don't possess the nature of that virtue. You may have done a virtuous action, but because you did something negative afterwards, then you destroyed that root of virtue. Okay? So it said, you know, to try and avoid doing that. Because when we cut our roots of virtue, then we're really left in a karmic no man's land. Yeah, because we really need those roots of virtue. We need those seeds of virtue. Okay. What makes us cut the root of virtue is specifically wrong views, but also anger. Yeah. So they can, you know, impede the ripening of our virtuous karma. So very important to avoid those two. And, you know, when we're angry at someone, like when we're really angry, we very seldom think, oh, I'm destroying my own karma, my own virtue. But if you can train yourself at that time when you're really angry to say to yourself, I'm destroying my own virtue, it's like cold water. It's like, whoa, you know, this person I'm mad at is not worth destroying my virtue for, definitely, you know. Yeah. So let's just drop the anger, because the anger is, you know, I'm the chief victim of my own anger. It harms me much more than it harms the other person. So to pay attention to that, not get carried away by our anger and irritation and blaming mind. Okay, It's good if we can to do 21 Vajrasattva mantra before going to bed in the evening, because that prevents our whatever negativity from multiplying during the time we're sleeping. If you can't do that, then at least do the 21 first thing when you wake up in the morning. If we do 100,000, then it really purifies things. So the 21 prevents it from multiplying, but the 100,000 purifies it, so it impedes its ripening. These are just little tidbits here about karma that I want to make sure that we covered. Whereas we usually talk about karmic seeds carrying the potency of the action, then when you get to the Prasangika school, they start talking about, that when you get to the Prasangika, they talk about what carries the potency, or what is the potency, is the having happened of the action. Some people translate it as disintegratedness, but I don't think that's a very good translation. It's the having ceased of an action, the having happened of an action. The fact that this action happened, is leaving a potency that can ripen in terms of our rebirth or what we experience in our life or the kind of environment that we're attracted to living in. So this having ceased, or this having happened, jhigpa, remember we had some interesting discussions about jhigpa. Not jhigpa. Jhigpa is the disintegrating. Jhigpa, the ZH, is the having disintegrated, the having happened. Okay? So this is the state of destruction. It's an affirming negative. Okay? So what is being affirmed is that the action happened. What is being negated is that it no longer exists. It's the having happened of the action. Okay? So this, this jhigpa, it's an impermanent phenomena. It too would fall into this category of abstract composites. Certainly not form, and it's certainly not consciousness, okay? But it's the state of the activities having ceased. And this remains with the mere eye, or with the mental continuum, until conducive circumstances are there, in which case its potential then ripens and it transforms into the result. Okay, so it's a potency that's not just the mere cessation of the action, but it has the capacity to produce an effect in the future. Okay, so the fact that this action happened, the action no longer is happening, but the fact that it happened has a potency that having happened, can bring the karma effect. When I ask, then what's the difference between a karmic seed, which is a positive phenomena, and a having happened, which is an affirmative negative? They say, well, the affirmative negative is the result of the action, and the karmic seed is the cause of the result. But that doesn't make any sense, because what's the result of the action is the thing that is holding that potency, which will lead to the result. So I haven't been able to get completely satisfying answers about this. Yeah, quite interesting when you really start debating it. Because is there a jhigpa of the jhigpa? and a Shigpa of the Shigpa of the Shigpa. And, you know, anyway. Okay. Going back to the thing when we were talking about seeds and imprints, in terms of karma, they're basically the same. The difference between seeds and imprints, or seeds and latencies, comes when we're talking about afflictions. Okay? Because the seed of the affliction is what? We're not angry now, but we still have the seed of anger in our mind stream. So when the other circumstances come, that seed transforms into manifest anger. Okay? So that seed is an afflictive obscuration because it's, you know, what binds, you know, one moment of anger gives it the potential to become another moment of anger, even though there's a space in between when you aren't angry. But the latencies or imprints of the afflictions are cognitive obscurations, because those are things that cloud the mind and prevent the mind from seeing both truths simultaneously. Okay, so you can eliminate the seeds of karma, but you still have the latencies of karma. I mean, you can eliminate the seeds of afflictions and still have the latencies of the afflictions.
And those seeds are not neutral. They're not neutral.
Though, yeah, the seeds of that karma, yes, would be non-virtuous. Okay.
When you said, Venerable, that they prevent the mind from seeing the two truths?
Yeah, simultaneously.
Simultaneously.
Yeah, simultaneously is important there. In the Pali tradition, in general, they say that if you create negative karma, it's not possible to purify it completely unless you experience some kind of result. And so they will say that even arhats, and even the Buddha in the Pali canon, will experience pain. So they no longer, the karmic seeds that could ripen in a rebirth, arhats, those seeds can no longer ripen. They may still be on the mind stream, obscuring it, but they can't ripen because the arhat have eliminated all the afflictions. Okay? But the seeds are still there, so they're part of the obscurations to omniscience. And also, there may be seeds of other kinds of negative karma, you know, that aren't the karmas that would cause a rebirth, but could cause some kind of pain. And so, you know, they say that an arhat or a Buddha could experience physical pain, not mental pain, but physical pain. And so they cite a story in one of the sutras where the Buddha stepped on a thorn and it was painful for him. In the Mahayana way of looking at the Buddha, you know, the Buddha has completely purified those kinds, you know, all seeds, and you know they're no longer there. The Buddha experiences no pain, physical or mental whatsoever. So there's different views, you know, according to the traditions. Okay. So there's some story, I can't remember it exactly, maybe somebody else does, about Mahamoggallana, that one of the Buddha's close disciples. And he was killed. He tried to fly away. He had, supernormal powers, so he tried to fly away. But the karma was very heavy, and he was killed. Does anybody remember the exact story?
He was beaten by a bunch of, like, people came and he was meditating, and there was, like, all these guys with sticks or something.
Yeah, maybe he was beaten. He tried to fly away.
Yeah.
Yeah, with his powers, but
yeah,
he could.
Yeah, horrific.
Yeah. So, you know, from the viewpoint of the Pali tradition, you know, they would say, well, there was some negative karma that, you know, was left that resulted in him being killed and experiencing that pain. From the Mahayana viewpoint, you might say, well, maybe there's some karma there that would bring that about, but he wouldn't experience any pain whatsoever. Yeah, and some people might even say that it would, you know, that it's just an appearance of Mahamogliana getting beaten, that he wasn't, you know, it wasn't really karma ripening. That's another one we have to ask the Buddha about. Okay, then another kind of subtopic, all these little tidbits here, is there's this thing that's mentioned in the Abhidharma Kosha about merit acquired in relationship to substances. So a substance is something that is commonly used, some physical kind of object. So for example, a library for Dharma books, a meditation hall, classrooms for the Dharma teachings, temples, Sangha seats, Sangha housing, mattresses for the Sangha, you know, kind of these kinds of substances that can be offered to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and through which we can create a lot of virtuous karma. The idea being that we offer this physical thing, and then every time the Buddha or the Sangha uses it, we get good karma from it. Okay? So they say that, for example, the people who offer money to build a temple or to build Chenrezig Hall or to build Gotami House or whatever, that by the power of the Sangha using it, then they create continually virtuous karma, yeah? Because, you know, their good intention to create a place for the Sangha to practice, then every time the Sangha's practicing and creating merit, because of their good intention to create that space and be involved in it, they're also creating merit. Okay? So it's very good to donate to these kinds of things. So I remember asking one of my teachers about this. I kind of grilled him. but I was saying, you know, if I make robes for His Holiness, do I create merit every time that His Holiness wears the robes? Yeah. And Geshe Sonam said yes. Yeah. So, you know, and this is true even if you don't have a super virtuous motivation. It's especially good if you have a really virtuous motivation. But even if you don't have a super virtuous one, then you're still creating good karma by the, you know, in relationship to the substance that you offered. And he said, even if His Holiness doesn't use the robes and gives them away by someone else using them, you acquire merit. Okay? And you also acquire merit by giving His Holiness something that he can give to others. Yeah. So this is very encouraging, you know, because clearly we make a lot of offerings to His Holiness. He can't use all of that for himself. He has no use for it. He's a simple monk, you know. So, but he gives it to support the Tibetan government, to support various charities, to support the monastic communities. And so in that way, we accumulate merit through giving to him, and we accumulate merit through those things being used in virtuous ways by other people. Okay? And also, if you pool, like you make a donation together with other people, so you pool your resources and give it for a big purpose, then then whatever you offered, if you, you know, let's say you're making a monetary offering, then it doesn't really get exhausted until all the money from that big pool of money is exhausted. Okay? So, for example, when His Holiness gives teachings in India, they serve tea and nowadays bread to the Sangha. So it's incredibly virtuous. You make an offering towards the tea and the bread, and then you can imagine, you know, your offering, maybe you only give $10 or $100 or whatever it is, you know, that you're offering even just one drop of tea to all the 30,000 people who are sitting there, and surely at His Holiness's teachings among 30,000 people, there's got to be some bodhisattvas there, you know? So then you're making an offering to bodhisattvas and to everybody else who is there. So that's why every year when we went for the Long Rim teachings, we always made offerings on behalf of the Abbey, you know, not just as individuals, but on behalf of the Abbey, because then it's everybody here accrues the merit of making the offering, and it goes to, in this big pool of funds that offers tea and water and stuff to everybody. So then it's a merit bonanza. Yeah. But it's quite nice, you know, when you see, and you just see, you know, people's faith. I mean, people will line up for hours in the line to make donations for the tea and bread and for the monetary offering to the Sangha, because they have some idea of how virtuous it is. Yeah, we've stood in some of those lines, and we've learned, go early. Yeah. And make your offering at the beginning of the teachings, because the line's shorter than at the end of the teachings. I wonder if you get more good karma if you have to wait in line longer. Yeah. Yeah, when they're writing out the receipt, it's like, it takes 20 minutes. We just say Shravasti Abbey and don't mention the names. It makes it quicker. Okay. Okay, then there's another topic called causal and timely motivation. Okay. So what this means is when we do an action, there's a motivation that is right at the moment we're doing the action. That's called the timely motivation or the at-time motivation. I'd like to come up with a better word for it instead of timely, because timely... Yeah. Anyway, this is what it means here. It's the motivation when you're actually doing it. The causal motivation, maybe immediate motivation, immediate motivation. Okay, then the causal motivation may happen beforehand. Okay, so for example, before we go to India, we're already getting the money together to make the donation for the tea and bread. So that our causal motivation is something virtuous, and then when we go there, when we're in the process of giving it, we try and remember our virtuous motivation and give it with a virtuous motivation instead of just, whew, well, I'm glad I got that done. Yeah, now I don't have to worry about losing that money. You know, that kind of motivation isn't so good. Yeah, but also with negative actions, you know, we may plan something for a long time, so that may be a causal motivation. And then at the time of doing it, if our motivation is still negative, then it's the immediate motivation is also negative. Sometimes we can start out with a good motivation and it changes at the moment that we're doing the action, you know? You know, I don't know what's... You know what a good example is? that story that they always tell of the Buddha in a previous life, where he was the captain of the ship who killed the guy who was going to kill all the other people. So his causal motivation was virtuous. It was out of compassion for the perpetrator and the would-be victims. But the timely motivation was negative because it's assumed, according to the specific viewpoint, that whenever you kill, there's got to be a negative motivation. Okay, not everybody agrees with that, so there's some debate about this, but that's one example. We could start out with a negative motivation towards something and then catch ourselves so that when we actually do the action, we make sure we have a positive motivation. Yeah? So it's something to be aware of. They say that the immediate motivation is probably the stronger of the two, but the causal motivation is pretty important too. And so because of the, this is why when we first wake up in the morning, we generate the intention, today as much as possible, I'm not going to harm anybody, I'm going to be of benefit, I'm going to develop bodhicitta, because that acts as the causal motivation for everything that we do during the day. Yeah? So at least we have a good causal motivation. Then, of course, when we're in the process of doing something during the day, we may get irritated at somebody and speak sharply, or we may waste something that belongs to the Sangha because we're not thinking so clearly. But at least we're trying at the causal level to generate a good motivation. The thing is to try and remember that good motivation as much as possible throughout the day. Yeah, so that's why, if you have beepers and alarms and whatever, every time they go off, you think bodhicitta. Yeah, very effective to do that. Okay, then let's go back to the text here. Okay, so I'll read, so we get the transmission here. So, having contemplated them, meaning unskillful actions, how to turn from non-virtue and to practice virtue. So first is a general explanation. Having learned about non-virtuous and virtuous karmas and their effects, if you do not achieve uncontrived ascertainment of this topic of meditation, when you meditate on emptiness, you will reject karma and its effects, and whatever your practice, it is certain not to please the conquerors. That's a pretty strong statement, So this is why, this is what I talked about at the beginning of the talk, why it's so important to meditate on karma and its effects and not just have the attitude of, this is a topic for the initial level practitioners, so I can skip it because, I'm beyond that. Okay? Then there's some quotes from the King of Concentration Sutra. And the translation here is not so good, so I fixed it in some cases. You'll hear it as I read it. So the King of Concentration Sutra says, "The moon and the stars may fall from their places, mountains, cities, and the rest may disintegrate. The space element itself may take on another form, but you, the Buddha, will never speak false words." Okay, so really attesting to the Buddha's omniscience and the Buddha's compassion and his ability to teach the Dharma accurately so that we can trust what he says. And then further on in the sutra, the Buddha said, "Like magical illusions, bubbles, mirages, and lightning, all phenomena are akin to the moon's reflection in water." Okay, so none of them are substantial. "It is not the case that sentient beings who after death move on to another life are the children of Manu." Manu is the first human being at the beginning of the universe. Okay, I'll read it again so you can fix what's in your text. Okay, like magical illusions, bubbles, mirages, and lightning, all phenomena are akin to the moon's reflection in water. Okay, it is not the case that sentient beings who after death move on to another life or go on to another life are the children of Manu, the first, Manu's the first human being at the beginning of the universe. The meaning of that is, you know, the first children at the beginning of the universe sounds like they have no cause. So what the sutra is saying here is when sentient beings die, it's not that the karma gets lost and somehow when they get reborn, it's they, you know, there's no influence from previous karma. That's the meaning of the statement. So in other words, we carry the karma with us. Yet the karmas they accomplish, this is still the sutra, yet the karmas they accomplish do not disappear, virtuous or non-virtuous. They bear fruit accordingly. So they don't disappear unless, in the case of non-virtue, we purify it, or in the case of virtue, we destroy it by anger or wrong views. Okay? This logical approach is excellent, although subtle and difficult to comprehend. It is the perceived object of the conqueror, of the Buddha. Okay, so this approach is very excellent. It's difficult to understand how an action created in one life can bear a result in another life, but this is something that the Buddha can perceive. So the big topic of discussion between all the Buddhist tenet systems is what carries the karma and how does the energy, the potency of the karma go from the action created here to the result there. So the different schools have all different kind of theories about what carries the karma. We were just talking now about karmic seeds and the having happens, the jhigpas, and that those are the potencies that are carried, the actions completed, you know, and carries that potency to ripen as the result. Then what carries that? Okay? So from the Prasangika viewpoint, there's a temporary basis, and then there is a, I don't know the word for it, just all the time basis, yeah? The temporary basis would be the mental consciousness, but the actual basis would be the mere I. Yeah. The reason that the mental consciousness is a temporary basis is, at least in Sutrayana, because there's some moments where you don't have a consciousness that is capable of carrying the karma. Vasubandhu talks about these states without mind, which don't make much sense to me, but anyway, they make sense to Vasubandhu, so. And he probably knows more than me. So, even though he and I don't see eye to eye on everything. Like the structure of the universe, yeah. Oh, it's quite interesting, by the way. You know, some scholars think that there were two or perhaps even three Vasubandhus. Mm. Yeah, which makes sense, you know? Kind of one who was the Satantrika, one who was the Chittamaja. Yeah. So, anyway. Okay. So the mere I is the kind of, you could say, ultimate or, you know, continuous thing that carries the karma. But you can't find the mere I. Okay? So accordingly, regard the 10 non-virtues and the rest, put a halt to even the intention to commit them. That would be nice, wouldn't it? stop even the intention to do non-virtue. Since this system is very hidden and extremely subtle, discriminating intelligence is needed to establish it with certainty. In this regard, do not show bravado like in a contest. In other words, don't be arrogant and think you're a big know-it-all when it comes to understanding karma, because it's very subtle. Every day, examine your three doors and strive to be conscientious, for it is taught that all that occurs is a consequence of our actions. I don't think His Holiness would agree with everything that happens is a result of karma. Everything that happens that affects human happiness or suffering would be a result of karma. Then the next outline is in particular the way to purify yourself by means of the four powers. So it says, correct your transgressions with the procedures specific to each of the three kinds of ethical restraints. So with pratimoksha precepts, you know, you purify them by frustrations to the 35 Buddhas, you know, with Bodhisattva precepts, frustrations to the 35 Buddhas, also with Tantric precepts, you have to do 100,000 Vajrasattva recitations or do the self-initiation or take the empowerment.
There is a difference in purifying with the 35 Buddhas or Vajrasattva? Is there one that has more?
Well, they say Vajrasattva is more for Tantra, but that doesn't mean it doesn't purify all the other karmas. And they say that the 35 Buddhas, it's for a Bodhisattva's ethical downfalls, so specifically for Bodhisattva precepts, but it's going to purify everything else. For a pratimoksha precept, remember we talked about purifying the negativity, which we would do by one of the four opponent powers, and then purifying the offense itself, which is by doing posada, yeah, and confessing and making amends with the sangha community. Okay, so. It is said that the very best way to purify yourself of negativity is by means of the four powers. So whatever practice you do, do it together with the four powers. Yeah. Okay, so the first one here, it says strong and repeated regret about the non-virtue done is the force of eradication. So this is really regretting what we've done, not feeling guilty about it, not beating ourselves up about it, not saying we're the most awful person in the universe, you know, because we did it, but just feeling regret, you know. Why do we feel regret? Not simply because we harmed somebody else, but because we're going to have to experience the detrimental effect of our own actions. So we regret that we're doing things that are self-sabotaging. Regret is the most important of the four factors, because unless we have regret, we can't really purify anything at all. Yeah. Then the second one is the remedial behavior. So here it says memorizing sutras, meditating on emptiness, reciting profound dharanis, making images of the conquerors, striving to present offerings to the three jewels, and reciting the Buddha's names. These six, along with the others, make up the force of application of antidotes. So this is the specific remedy that you do. So memorizing sutras or reciting them, meditating on emptiness, meditating on bodhicitta, reciting mantras, making images of the Buddha's satsa, or you know, even photocopying images or printing images, something like that. Making offerings to the three jewels, saying the Buddha's names and the 35 Buddhas, that's what we're doing, is saying the Buddha's names. And then also included in this is offering service to your community, tutoring people, you know, doing volunteer work for a charity, giving a donation to Doctors Without Borders, volunteering at your Dharma Center, offering service at a monastery, any kind of virtuous action. So it doesn't have to be a specifically religious looking action. It can be any kind of virtuous action. Then third is refraining from misdeeds and transgressions in the future is the force of avoiding repetition. So this is the force of making a determination not to do it again. So it isn't sufficient just to regret the misdeed. It's also important to make some determination that we don't want to continue to repeat it. Otherwise, it becomes like those phony apologies that we give, you know, to people. Yeah, oh, I'm really sorry. And then we go and do the same mean thing again to them. Yeah, so you, there has to be some kind of determination to avoid it in the future. So sometimes we can't really truthfully say, I'm never going to do something again. Like, I'm never going to do idle gossip again. You know, that would almost border on lying. So when doing your statement of avoiding the action in the future, sometimes it's good to make it for a period of time and then be really, really attentive during that period of time. That helps you gain the confidence that you can, you know, okay, I went 3 whole days without idle gossip. That's incredible. Yeah? I mean, can we go 1 whole day without idle talk? Difficult. Yeah? Okay. So we might set ourselves a time period. And then fourth is generating bodhicitta and taking refuge constitutes the force of the basis. Basis here meaning whoever or whatever it was that we created the negativity in relationship to. So either holy beings, yeah, or sentient beings. So holy beings, you know, if we created negativity in relationship to them, we have definitely a negative attitude. So the way to repair that is by taking refuge in them. If we harmed other sentient beings, again, we have kind of a nasty attitude. The way to repair that is to generate bodhicitta. Okay? So you can see that, you know, if we really practice these four, our mind's got to change. And especially if we have a bad habit, you know, something that we do repeatedly that we really have to work on. If we practice these four sincerely and really go over them, you know, and do them closely and generate these different feelings, then for sure we'll be able to overcome the bad habit. Yeah, for sure it'll work. Regarding how negativities are purified, it is taught that the suffering to be experienced is shortened, lessened, or neutralized completely, or that which would otherwise be experienced severely in a lower rebirth occurs instead in the present life simply as a minor illness. Remember this over the next 2 days, that whatever unpleasant feeling you experience could have been the karma ripening in a hell realm for a long time. Okay. The four powers purify even karmas whose effects are certain to be experienced, and confession weakens their capacity to produce maturation events. Although restoration is possible, non-contamination is best. In other words, rather than fix, you know, put your leg in a cast after you've broken it, better not to break it. So rather than repairing, having to repair things through the four opponent powers after we create negativities, best is not to create them. Okay? And the thing is that even if we purify the potency so that it won't bring a painful result, still, by the force of having done some kind of negative action, it can prolong the time needed to attain certain levels of the path. So it can delay our attainments coming about. So that's why it says better not to do them in the first place. Okay, then the measure of having produced this attitude, turning from concern for this life and being interested mainly in future lives, is the measure of having produced a lesser capacity being's attitude. Okay, so here we are. This is the measure of not just understanding karma, but the measure of fulfilling the initial level practitioner's job. Okay, and then eliminating false ideas regarding this. Aspiring to achieve the excellent qualities, the result from a high, an upper rebirth, does not necessarily mean you are producing causes for samsara. The utterly certain explanation of the practice of the path shared with lesser beings is complete. Okay, so aspiring to achieve the excellent qualities that result from a higher rebirth does not necessarily mean you are producing causes for samsara. That's because a bodhisattva could also aspire to achieve the excellent qualities that result from a higher rebirth. Okay? But their bodhicitta is not producing the causes for samsara, it's producing the causes for awakening. But as a byproduct, they'll get a good rebirth in cyclic existence. Okay, so that's the end of the initial level practitioner's path that we practice in common with them. In common because we don't aspire to be an initial level practitioner. We want to be an advanced level practitioner, but to get to be that, we have to first practice the path in common with the initial being and the intermediate beings. Okay, so a few minutes for questions. Yeah?
So we ask, does the merit from building temples carry into future lives until the temple is physically destroyed?
So does the merit from building the temple carry into future lives? I think it carries into your death in this lifetime. So the merit is accrued by the person with the aggregates that created that karma. But after you are reborn, then you aren't getting the good karma from that. Yeah?
I'm not sure if this is for like, I'm questioning the four point of powers. There's some in everyone is creating karma, even if you're not Buddhist. Mm-hmm. But the four point of powers, is it a Buddhist because of the refuge, right? With the first three, anybody can.
Well, that, you know, there's got to be a modifying factor, because people who are following the fundamental vehicle path aren't going to generate bodhicitta. They're going to take refuge and, you know, at least neutralize their negative action, negative attitude towards somebody. So I think non-Buddhists can also purify. Yeah? I mean, they can create virtuous karma. So I think they can purify as well. Now, especially people when they have sincere regret and a real determination to avoid it in the future. Yeah. Yeah.
When you talked about children and children killing parents and intentions, I was reminded of recent news that I heard with young children playing with guns and accidentally killing their parents. Now,
oh, well, the cases of young children playing with guns and accidentally shooting a parent, there's no karma there because there's absolutely no intention on the child's part. Yeah. That happened. One of the incidents happened about 45 minutes away from here, where the in a Walmart, where a little toddler went into his mother's purse, which was one of the purses that the NRA sent, you know, says is childproof, and pulled out a gun and shot his mother in the middle of Walmart or whatever Kmart, whatever store was happened in Hayden.
So in that case, whose karma? What was the fruit of the karma? Whose karma?
The mother, the parent, yeah. Whoever the child kills, or even a sibling, you know, has some kind of negative karma that is ripening in them having a short life. Yeah. Then the karma that is, or what is making the child do that? I don't know. I mean, it's certainly not something good. And I think the chief repercussion, when you think about it, is what that child's going to live through as an adult and a teenager, knowing that as an innocent child, they did that. And the way the mind works, probably blaming themselves, even though there was absolutely no intention on their own part. And it's basically due to parental negligence and too many guns in society.
Mm-hmm. I was just wanting a little bit more clarification for my mind on when you were talking about you could use the four quantum powers for any practice that you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Like for instance, if you were doing something that maybe might not necessarily have a mantra involved in it.
Mm-hmm.
I was just trying to figure out how to do that. So you would have regret first before you took refuge with whatever the practice was, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And would the remedial action be actually doing the practice?
So you're talking about doing specific practice?
Yeah, say there's a sadhana practice that you have.
Uh-huh.
So you can use the four quantum powers with that? Even
right.
Though it's not, okay.
Right. And the remedial action would be just doing the practice.
Okay.
You know, especially whatever visualization is involved there, purification.
Okay.
And
just at the end of the practice, kind of, the termination has to do it again. So
right. Yeah, you just make sure you get all four in there.
Okay.
Yeah. This is the nice thing about doing Vajrasattva or 35 Buddhas, is that all four are right there in the practice, so you can't miss them. Okay, so if you have a chronic illness in this lifetime, can you do purification practice so that you have good health in a future lifetime? Of course, yeah. What you can't purify is karma that's already ripened, okay? So if you have a karma that ripened in you're having an accident and having a broken leg, you can't purify that and unbreak your leg, okay? Or if you have the karma that ripened in the sense of having, let's say, a chronic illness, then you can't, you know, that karma's already ripened. You can't purify it. You can maybe purify karma related to that illness, so that you don't get any worse, or so that you feel better, or so that you get medicine that would help you. Yeah. But karma that's already ripened, you know, it's water under the bridge.
And someone tried to sum up and said, so karma is one reaps what one sows in this life and every life until one sows no more.
This is why purification is important. And the most powerful purification is the realization of emptiness, which is also the realization that overcomes the ignorance and that stops us from creating more karma. So it is not the case that we have to experience the result of acting every single karma we've ever experienced, we've ever created before we attain awakening, because then it would be impossible to attain awakening because we have a beginningless store of karma. Okay, so this is why purification is quite important. Okay. Yeah, can they hear the questions, or do I need to repeat them? No, but for the tape, for people who listen afterwards, should I repeat it? They'll hear it through there. Okay.
So it says, a person who has not heeded the precepts but breaks one of the precepts, compared to someone who has heeded the precept but commits the same negative action,
okay.
Does the latter have a stronger negative?
Okay. Now that I've heard two different things on. One is that it's heavier for the person who has the precept because they had to overcome the barrier that the precept established to doing the action in order to do it. So it has a stronger force behind it. It's going to be heavier. On the other hand, I've heard that it's less powerful because chances are, if it's a person who practices the Dharma, they will also know to purify. So that it will become less. So maybe both.
Is it an accurate analogy to think of neural pathways in the brain as a physical manifestation of how karmic disintegratedness works on the mind?
Now, if neural pathways were how karma worked, then when you died, all your karma would be abolished. Because your brain ceases to operate. Yeah. Now that is not how it happens. Your brain can cease, but the karmic potency goes on to the next life. Okay? So that's a very good refutation of why the brain is not the mind. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
How do they explain when they say that what we're experiencing this life is from actions from other lifetimes? Is it true that also we can experience some results from stuff we've done in this life, in this life?
Yes, we can experience results in this life from actions we've done this life. Usually it's very strong actions, either very powerful negativity or very powerful virtue. That we can experience in the same lifetime as we create. Okay, shall we dedicate?
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it, have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lhasa's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Idam Gurana Mandala Kamiratayami.
Due to this merit,
may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends.
May the deeds of
explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, Shravasti.